Access number 32394, Mr. Don Farrington, Real 4. Now, one thing is, when have they taught you deflection shooting, though? Because the thing about shooting at things in the air is you have to allow for things.
Yeah,
don't
that's right.
When have they taught you that on the ground? Or because some gunners used shotguns and things to you know, I mean, when were you taught deflection shooting?
Well, they give you a demonstration about, they have a gun that's lined up inside the tutor room, if you like, on the ground, and it's on a table, the gun, and it's on a trestle where you can move the gun about, and it's teaching you if there's a movement to left or right according to the current of the wind and all this business, you can move this, and they electronically controlled it so that there'd either be a wind, a northeasterly or northwesterly wind or whatever it was, and you were able to just follow it round, and then you reached a certain point, and if you did that, it would take care of the wind velocity. It's all very much...
But it's not so much the wind velocity, it's that the target will have moved. And that's what deflection shooting means.
Oh, yeah, yes, but it also depends on the...
The wind as well.
The wind as well. But I think all that's incorporated on the fact that they did so much of it, and then when you went up to do your first one or two, there would be somebody with you. And he would be watching this and say, would you just try, because we kept going round in a certain area, certain circular plan, and we would get instructions coming through to say, adjust accordingly and use a certain amount of common sense. If you think you're within the normal range and the ability to be ready to fire, then just carry on.
What were the sights like you were using?
The sights? You mean the gun sights you're talking about? I can't remember.
That's fine, because you didn't do much gun.
No, you see, this is the point.
I do understand. Yeah. But you didn't do any clay pigeon shooting or anything else on the ground?
We did, no, we did, what's that other thing, like, it's just clay pigeon shooting of a word.
With a shotgun?
That's right, we did that once, I remember that. That's all we did. I quite enjoyed that, going out. But that was, I think, there's only... Only ever once went out on that, but I don't know where it was.
And that's just again learning deflections and shooting.
It could be, yes, to do with that.
What do you think of the Blenheim? Do you remember it as an aircraft to fly in? I mean, just as a thing to be in, and the Anson and the Hampton.
No, I think it's unfair to criticise, simply because at the Isle of Man, unfortunately, what the training aircrafts were Blenheims, Ansons or Hamdens. Now the Hamdens and the Blenheims had all been ex-operational. They'd been used on operations and then brought back and finished with operations because they weren't good enough to carry on. So that shows you the weaknesses of aircraft that have been quite used a lot on operations, and then found that there were no use for further sending these aircraft on serious operations.
Now, what do you remember?
But they're all right for training.
What do you remember of the Blenheim and the Hampden?
The Blenheim, I had unfortunately an accident in one where I was very lucky, and we took off, and then suddenly the port engine went dead. We'd only got up a few feet. Fortunately, the aircraft, the pilot rather, the front, tried his best to get us down as easily as possible, but as he come round on a tight bend to come round onto a lower level, the other engine cut, and unfortunately it went straight in with the nose down, and I was sat in the Blenny, which has its turret in the middle of the aircraft. That's the gunner's position, and that's where the wireless operator used to sit in the Blenny. And because it had gone in nose first, I was all right, because fortunately, and heaven knows why, it didn't catch fire. And we saw a farmer running, who was in the same field, and he was running towards us, actually, and I thought, well, you better keep away. Anyway, I got out of my hatch, and then I went round to look at the pilot. And, of course, they'd sent for the ambulance, and what had happened, I don't know quite what the fault was with the aircraft, but there was the pilot was actually badly hurt. He wasn't killed, and he didn't die, because eventually he recovered and went on operations. But what did happen, he had to have his leg completely regrafted with skin. It was such a bad condition, and I hadn't got a scratch. And that
what were
was
you
my
thrown about? I mean, what was the impact like? Most people haven't been in an air crash.
Well, it wasn't because he went in sort of nose first, and I was sort of suspended in midair. It wasn't quite all that bad. So the impact obviously was right at the nose end.
So for you, it wasn't as bad as it might have been.
Oh no, I was very lucky. Very lucky, because he was very badly hurt, and but I did meet up with him in hospital afterwards, so I knew he was being looked after.
What did you think of the Blenheim other than that? Or
but
the
Blenheim generally is the same with the Hampden, the other aircraft which I flew in. I would hate it to have gone on operations.
Now why?
And those are because the aircraft, first of all, it wasn't a fair assessment, because they were old aircraft.
No, I understand that, you've said that, but what was wrong with them?
Well, the fact was there was so much technically that could go wrong with them on Blenheims, which was due to usage. If we'd have been in new ones, brand new aircraft, and all, not used very much, I would probably have thought they were very good.
At that time?
But I must confess, I wouldn't like to have done operations on a Blenheim because of its position. We just had a little turret there, and your wireless operation was very confined space. The Hampden was even worse. The Hampden was a terrible aircraft.
Why? What was terrible about it?
Well, the structure of it inside. You just had to realise, when you've been other aircraft, exactly, you know, how much discomfort there can be in those sort of aircraft. So from my point of view, those to me were not... I'm very, very glad that I didn't have to do operations in them.
Now, the third of the aircraft was a different kettle of fish. It's not operational, but it was quite a famous and well-loved aircraft, the Avro Anson.
The Anson, to me, is absolutely fantastic. We did everything in that Anson. We went through very fierce storms, and we were all right. We bounced about, but we were still all right. They did everything with that Anson, went low-level flying. I fell in love with the Anson. It was a terrific aircraft.
So what was it?
It was so secure, and so we felt safe in it, no matter what was happening. And again, as I say, it was so safe and so secure that I would give it first-class marks every time. It's a great little aircraft. It wasn't much used on operations, but it was a good training aircraft.
Enough room in it, comfortable?
Oh yes, room was quite good, and the wireless operator had a good spacious amount of room to operate. That's why I flew a lot of hours in Anson's during the training at the Outwork.
At Jerby,
yeah, at the Isle of Man.
Now, there's a couple of things that we haven't mentioned. One is aircraft recognition.
Oh, yes.
Did a course there. Had you done it before?
Yes, that was...
Tell me about aircraft recognition generally.
Well, aircraft recognition was quite simply that they had a film there with all the different types of aircraft in different positions. And what they would do, they would say, I want you to select and mark down what A represents, what aircraft it is. And it could be any of the operational or any of the training aircraft. So we had to recognise, but mainly, in addition to our aircraft, and more important, you had to recognise the enemy aircraft. So we got all the different types of enemy fighters or enemy bombers that were being used at that time. They used to come on first, and those were the most important ones as far as we were concerned, to recognise A, your own aircraft when you're flying, and B, recognise the enemy. So that was very valuable.
And was it difficult, or was it?
It was difficult to a certain extent because there's so many variations, but I think most people did got an average mark, I would think, for spotting every aircraft. You would be a real wizard, because don't forget these photographs were being taken at certain heights, at certain levels. Either they're on one side or they're coming towards you, or they're going away from you, so you're either seeing the front or the back of the aircraft, and to give you enough sort of sufficient time to check on which type of aircraft you're looking at the time. So that was another interesting item they had.
Now, any other courses you did there that you can remember? I mean, it's all part of this gunnery, because you didn't drop any bombs or anything like that, did you?
Oh, no.
Or any of the other stuff?
We went on a lot of exercises which were different kinds, connected with getting used to when you're going on operations.
Now, tell me about them.
Well, we used to be going on a certain tour of different types of the country, our country.
Now, this including Jerby.
Including Ireland and Scotland and all over, actually. All over the British Isles. We could go on a particular... usually the timing would be about maybe 2 to 3 hours at a stretch. And they were all training... They were training training navigators there.
At the same time?
At the same time. Now, they had the pilots of these aircraft, when we got there, were all mainly all aircraft, all airmen who had actually... been on operations, and they were coming, they'd done the tour of operations, and to keep them occupied, they were bringing them back, so they'd make them trainee pilots for the navigators. The navigators would be the actual trainees on that. They'd be fully fledged pilots, of course, and I would go as a fully fledged wireless operator. And we would take with us a trainee wireless operator. There were some of those as well there. So I was used to go on these flights, and we'd take a trainee wireless operator, and we had to make notes about what was happening. And sometimes I'd go with a pilot and navigator, trainee navigator, on our own, without the trainee wireless operator. So it varied.
Right, so that's it. Now, anything else about your time at jury? You're there until... you're only there 2 or 3 months.
So yeah, no, twelve months altogether.
Oh, I misread the year. Yeah, 12 months. Right, so there's a lot happening there.
Yeah, there is.
Now, you're there till June 43. Sorry, I misread it as June 42. It's taken a long time.
It has. Well, the reason for this is that when we passed out on our, got our sergeants, my sergeants, Brevi, have you got these dates down there?
Yes, I see where the confusion is. Right, that's in June, and then you get a posting there. So you get a passing out parade is June 42. That's the end of the course.
Yeah, that's right.
And you get yourself. So tell me about that. You're promoted to sergeant. You get your air gunners brevet, but you're still a wireless operator, right?
Oh yes, it's a wireless operator air gunner. It's a joint occupation.
And did it make much difference becoming a sergeant?
Oh, did it make a difference? Well, first of all, remember that we're the Isle of Man, and secondly, there's no rationing. They're all sustained as far as food's concerned, agriculture wise, and that they've always plenty of eggs, meat, and rationing isn't on the cards. So once we'd passed as an NCO, we were in different billets. We all had a bedroom of our own. We were served actually in the mess, in the same way the officers were.
Now, what was the sergeant's mess like? Tell
and the
that.
Sergeant's mess was very good. I always remember the first time I went into it, all the tables were laid out with white tablecloths, all nicely decorated, all sorts of things on the tables, you know, the whatever it is meal you were having, all the necessary condiments, and everything was so, I think, elaborate in those days, and that was because it was in the sergeant's mess. And the food, well, we had egg and bacon practically every day, breakfast. I mean, that was a luxury. But because they were self-sustained, we were getting the first call on the food from the Manx people. So we got, as I say, plenty of eggs sustaining us, and we also got bacon as well, and anything like we got chickens, plenty of chickens. So we were being fed really well. It was like another world altogether, and of course you're treated differently, in as much as there were a lot of respect for air crew at that time. I really was very, very fortunate, and the reason that we stayed so long at the Isle of Man again was coincidental, was the fact that when the time comes, or it used to come round, that people like myself, who was then a wireless operator air gunner completed, he's ready for posting to an operational training unit. Now, that's the first time you begin to crew up and make a member of a crew. But to get onto that list where you were posted there to an OTU, they had a table like a football league. And when you first go and you pass out as a gunner, you then become eligible to get posted, and you go on the bottom of the league table. And as each application for transfer to OTU comes through, you're posted. And I was at the time, because we'd only just passed out on that parade, I was at the bottom of the list because only just having, but above me were the members still waiting to be posted. They all went in turn. And because of how I was fixed, it was quite a long time before I got the posting.
Well, they gave you a job, didn't they? They gave you a job as an instructor.
Well, this is what I was doing. Yes, this is what we're doing on this.
They kept all your successful calls back to act as well as operating
instructors. That's right. That's it.
Now, yeah. Tell me about that.
Well, that was interesting, in as much as they'd actually completed their wireless course, so it was just getting used to the flying side of it and being operating it from a flight point of view. So they were given that extra training to see if they could cope with the things that we got on training, which was all kinds of things would go wrong. Either your set might go wrong, or you get something faulty which you'd have to try and correct. So all these sort of things came into their training and helped us to improve on our.
So while you were training them, you were improving your own.
Exactly,
skills.
Very, very much so. Because you see, all that time now came to very experienced by the time I got on operations. So it.
Anything happened else while you were during that period as a wireless operator instructor?
Oh yeah, many, many things actually. From time to time, we had accidents of different kinds. We had one accident came down, and we had to what they call belly land. He's lost the control.
This isn't your plane.
Pardon?
This isn't your plane, is it? This is someone else's.
Oh, sorry.
This is someone else's plane, isn't it?
Well, it was an Anson. And when he said someone else's plane, how do you mean? Yeah, I was a wireless operator, and the pilot.
So this is your second crash.
Oh, I had about three actually.
Oh, sorry. Tell us all about them. So I didn't understand what you meant. Carry on.
So I got the message through that he was coming in to.
What sort of aircraft was it?
This is an Anson, and is when he was trying to wind down his the wheels. Actually, preparation for landing, the gears, there's something went wrong with him, and he couldn't get them down at all, so he had to, what we call, belly flop, just flop down, but it was had to be done very, very skillfully, because he had to make sure he wasn't at an angle, and also the speed with which he was going at was also had to be controlled. And he made a perfect belly flop, so he did skidded along the surface of the runway, and fortunately came to a stop. So we got out of that one.
Not hurt again.
No.
And you said there was another one.
There was another one rather similar to this, and he got me to send a message back to our headquarters in Jerby at the time, and he wanted me to send a message to say would they have the ambulance etc. ready because his controls had gone for the getting the wheels down. It was another, but this time it was a Blenheim, anyway. He wanted me to send it in plain language. Now, normally we have to do something like that in code, but he said, no, I want to listen to it to see you sending what I'm asking you to do. So he sent it through with the navigator to me, to give to me, and on it was a message, please fix, it was to the effect that he was got problems, that he may not be able to get his wheels down at landing. The gear mechanism had gone. So I sent it out, and they arranged for the ambulance to be there and everything at the runway, when we came in to land. The dove obviously got the message all right. And he came in all right, and I thought he got away with it, because it was as he was coming circling round to come in, he suddenly realised his wheels were engaging and they were coming down. So we saved again. So again, due to a faulty control area, we almost actually did think, because with the Blenheim, we might not have been so fortunate with the landing, if you got to do a belly flop landing with a Blenheim, because it's heavier than the Hansen.
So it might not skim.
It could have been, yeah, they can just slightly skim along it, but with this, is a heavier type of aircraft, it could have cracked open, you know, affected the both engines, but it didn't.
Well, any other stories?
But, yeah, there is another one. I've got, I'm just trying to think of, there was another one.
So anything else? We've looked, and you've got the two dates. We've got but we have now got the dates of those two incidents. So the crash with the Blenheim was the 28th of July 1942, and the belly flop landing in the Anson with the Polish pilot was the 19th of April 43.
Yeah,
so
that's
just helped people to find things when they look.
Yeah, that's it.
So it's just anything else really about your time at Derby?
Well, only to say that the whole of the time I was there, I was very happy. I got very friendly with two or three people, and we used to go out, two people in particular. We used to go everywhere when we
got. So what would you do?
Well, we always fairly frequently we used to go into Douglas and spend the day.
I don't know where Jury is. Is it quite close to Douglas, is it?
Well, Jerby's at the north end of the Isle of Man. Douglas is on the south end, where the southern end, where the usual not the pleasure beach, the big hotels are. All I remember, particularly at some of those places, all the major hotels along the front of Douglas Promenade were filled mainly with either naval or at the, partially, it was also Italian POWs were housed there during the war, and they had a life of Riley.
So you enjoyed it in Douglas as well?
I enjoyed it, yes. And we used to do our studying at Jerby, which was very close to the beach at that end, the northern end of the Isle of Man, and we got our notebooks out and sat on the sand dunes quite often, nice sunshine, studying all our different things that we had to learn. And it was fantastic because of the fact of, first of all, we were not getting any bombs, and secondly, we were having plenty of flying instruction, and generally speaking, with the food as it was a wonderful experience considering what it could have been like.